Well, good morning. This is a panel discussion on building a true, good, and beautiful culture in the grammar school. And so delighted to have you here and our panelists to discuss this and maybe put some flesh and skin on the bones of their talks even that many of you have probably heard. The way these panel discussions work, you've got some cards on your seat and you'll have time while they give an opening statement and maybe I toss them a few softball questions to write your questions down. Please note, if you're asking a question of a specific panelist, just write their name at the top. If it's for all, just put all at the top so we know who we'd like to ask. And, of course, our panelists can chime in on other questions as well, but give you time to do that. My name is Jamie Kane. I'm the head of school at Dominion Classical Christian Academy just outside of Atlanta. And I'm going to give our panelists an opportunity to introduce themselves and give an opening statement. And so we'll start with Leslie Collins.
I'm Leslie Collins. I'm the head of school at Covenant Academy in Cypress, Texas, which is near Houston. And there you go.
I'm Matt Whitling, and I'm the principal at Logos School in Moscow, Idaho.
I'm Ron Gilley. I am a lead grammar teacher at Trinitas Christian School in Pensacola, Florida, and teach fifth grade there.
Go ahead and give an opening statement.
Sure. I'm actually, forgive me, I'm going to read what you have there. So hopefully just hearing it out loud will give some thought to that. Jesus Christ is truth, goodness, and beauty. If we desire our grammar schools to reflect what is true and good and beautiful, our grammar students must resemble Jesus Christ. The culture is a byproduct. Building culture, therefore, becomes less about establishing rules for what our students do and how they do it, and more about what we love and how we show it. For students to love what is true and good and beautiful, teachers must study Jesus Christ and be continually transformed by the renewing of their minds. We must recognize that we are often glory stealers, seeking to find ways to glorify ourselves instead of our Creator. As we are renewed and transformed into glory givers, so will our students be. If we are to build a culture that is true, good, and beautiful, we must first cultivate an environment where the student's identity is found primarily in his value as an image bearer. We must put aside boasting and perfectionism as attempts to find merit on our own. In this environment, accomplishments are a result of that identity, and we are loved regardless of strength or weakness. Christ's love motivates us and instructs us how to relate to others in a way that honors them. Peace is pursued, carrots and sticks and tools of manipulation are put away. Potential of competition to both unite and divide is recognized, and its use is wisely stewarded. In all things, we are about the heart, not merely the behavior. Every moment, every corner, every conversation becomes an opportunity to give glory to the one who is transforming us. And through our community, though it may be diverse in preferences, backgrounds, and abilities, we work from and build upon the assumption that we are more alike than we are different. We encourage a love for the lovely by loving it ourselves, a love for work by delighting in our calling, and respect for others by loving them and speaking well of them. We establish trust with our students by loving them and connecting with them in such a way that they can't resist following us. Jesus tells us that students will become like their teachers if they will love what we love and do what we do. He has commissioned us to make disciples and multiply. If we love our students as he loves them, then we will do this, and the byproduct will be the culture that is true, good, and beautiful.
Amen to that. And I would just add the, and I think Leslie nodded at this too, is the culture that you establish in your school is going to be the culture that you think God has established in his. Right? So it's an imitative, it's a reflective game that you're playing. So God's a father. And if you're a father, you're copying him. And so the sorts of things that you think God would laugh at are the sorts of things that you laugh at. The sorts of things that you think God would spank for, you spank for. Our problems are, almost all of our problems on this front are misunderstanding our dad.
I agree with both of those things, and we'll just speak a little bit more to the maybe the nuts and bolts of it. We have to be purposeful in training. We've talked a lot about here about how we teach truth, goodness, and beauty. I mean, we've talked about this at every ACCS conference, how we teach truth, goodness, and beauty, and we try to do that across our curriculum. But when it comes to building that into the culture, you also have to train it. Lots of ways that you do that, and I know that's what you all want to hear, and hopefully that's what we'll get down to talking about. But just to throw some starting points out, maybe we start every day with a worship service at our school, and so we're training. You know, this is the practice for loving God. This is how we love God, and so that really starts every day out on the right foot. And then we spend lots of time, especially in the grammar stage, training what does it look like to love your neighbor in lots of different ways. What does it look like to love your neighbor, from the gentleman holding the door for girls to the older students caring for and serving the younger students and interacting with them, teaching them to sing, cleaning up our own messes, being good stewards of our building, confronting each other over sin. All of these things are loving your neighbor, and we train those things very purposefully. And then the result, then, I think, is the beautiful culture.
If you have questions you've written down, you can just hold up your cards, and I'll come back and grab them. Just pass them to the end of the row there. While you're doing that, as you pass some questions up, let me just ask. Ron kind of started in that direction. What are a couple of practical things that that you do at your school that you feel cultivate the true good and the beautiful, and maybe one thing that one goof up you made that you thought might cultivate it, and turned out to have a different result. That may be more difficult to think of. I don't know.
One, I don't know if this is the most important thing or not, but one thing that we do that I think there's merit for is assembly sayings, and I talked about this a little while ago, but maybe it's just me and I'm pretty simplistic, but there are a lot of things that we want to teach our kids about a lot of different situations, and the heart is maybe the same. But young kids don't know how to apply it to a thousand different realms. So for me, if there's some way to capture the idea, so for an example, an assembly saying that we have is, I'll say hustle, and the students will say to help out. And then they say dishes, dishes, dishes. And usually we do that assembly saying before Thanksgiving. And what I want for them to see is how many people are giving themselves away for them all around them all the time. Because our kids are surrounded by sacrifice, but it's really easy to not lift your eyes and see it. So it's mostly, I want them to see their mom and how hard she works on their behalf. And when I say hustle and they say to help out, we're thinking of Thanksgiving. They say dishes, 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 which means come to rescue mom from the kitchen, right? Their job is to work hard and help out in a myriad of different situations. Or I'll say leave it, and they'll say better than you found it. And that's something my dad taught me is, you know, if he borrowed a truck from a friend to take a load to the dump, he would always, on the way back to give the truck back to the friend, he'd always go by the gas station and fill the thing up, which, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's not a big deal. But it is, right? I mean, that's love. And Dad taught it to me in the way that he put gas in a pickup truck. But there's a thousand opportunities in life when you borrow anything from anybody or when you go into a room. I want our students to think, I'm going into a room. How do I leave it better than I found it? And there are there's the concrete world where you can pick up trash from the hallway, and we want students to do that. But there's also the next level, which is how do you leave a room of friends better than you found them? You know, how do you leave a conference like this better than you found it? And it's, I mean, it applies to everything. And again, for me, unless I have an assembly saying, I won't remember it, and I don't do a good job of teaching and reminding my students what it is that we're trying to do. So, and then you want a blooper. You want us to tell a blooper. I don't know. I was teaching our sixth graders years ago about trying to teach them about faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. And I had a sixth grade girl rebuke her friend over a swimming suit that that probably wasn't that bad, right? But but she got this idea in her head that modesty was the standard, and my parents' modesty is everybody's standard, and if you don't meet up to that standard, I'm going to wound you because I love you. And so that was a mess, and it was all my fault. But I don't know. That's what comes to mind.
I'm going to start with a mess. Not a terrible mess, but this was, I was thinking through what great principles, and I couldn't come up with any, but then I could think of something that needs to be fixed. I'm a problem solver, so I want to fix things. So we have lunch in our cafe auditoria thingy, our hall, and our K through 6 have lunch together. And we have a tradition that after we pray, then it's silent for 5 minutes because we actually want them to eat. And we find that to be very helpful. And it's easy to just transition from prayer to silence to now just eat. And then we'll let you know when that 5 minutes is up. And So that was a good intention, a very motherly thing for all of us to desire, and that I don't think was wrong. There are things that we had to, there's still that we have to combat with that, which is, and now you may speak. That's actually not the spirit of what we're going for. And so then you feel very Dickens-like, just saying, and now we'll stop being so joyful, having your voice back. And so you don't want to do that either. And it's challenging. So what we are going to do, if I'm ever asked to talk on this again, I'll let you know how it goes. But what we're going to do is have, rather than silent lunch, we're going to have listening lunch for 5 minutes. So I went through and found for each month, or 10 months of our school year, I found 10 pieces of music that are about 5 minutes long that rather than have them be silent, we will play them. And if it's a YouTube video and it's decent, they can watch that as long as there's not something at the bottom of the screen coming up. So it'll be a listening lunch. And my desire was that we don't live in a culture where families are listening to the classical music station, nor do they love to hear classical music. But by the nature of being human, if I pair classical music with food, they will love it. And if I allow them to have that 5 minutes where they're actually eating, then I get to have a moment where I am cultivating truth and goodness and beauty. So that was a foible that we just kind of needed to make better. And I'm sure that we'll goof up a lot along the way, and I'll figure out something that else that needs to be fixed. There are plenty of things that need to be fixed.
One of the things that that we do that I think teaches a lot of great lessons is we have the students be responsible for caring for the building. So I'm not talking about stripping and waxing the floors in the grand hall or anything like that, but they clean up their own classrooms. Every Friday and sometimes in the middle of the week as well, we'll vacuum the carpets and wash the windows and wipe down all the desks and cubbies with the disinfecting wipes and dust the room. And we also take on a few chores around the school, and all of the classes are involved. So the students are caring for that gift that they've been given. Okay, so we're teaching stewardship with that. We're teaching them to be thankful for what they have, and manifest that in the way that they care for it. It doesn't always work in the restrooms as well, but we're still working on that. One of the bloopers, of course, there are lots of them, but we strive to have good conversation at the lunch table, not the that Mrs. Collins is talking about, but the good conversation that they're working to have as well. So we teach etiquette. We teach them how to talk to one another, and what happens, I think, sometimes when we get really excited about something that we're doing is we forget some of the pieces that go with that. And so what we've forgotten is to remind them about house rules. There are certain things that just don't need to be part of this conversation, because where your mom and dad may let you watch a certain movie or play a certain video game, your brothers and sisters may not get to do that because of their house rules, and let's be respectful of their house rules. So we've had to put out fires over the years about the different things that most of us would agree are certainly not sinful things, but they violate house rules. So, you know, one should be one of the laws of the teacher. You got to think through every single thing and anticipate every single thing, and we bloopered there.
This is a question for all of you, and just to remind you, if you have other questions, write them down and pass them to the end of the row and hold them up, and I'll come back and grab them. What structures do you have in place for older students to interact with younger students? And maybe enlarge that a little bit, talk about the role of that interaction in building a true and good and beautiful community.
We do a couple of things. We have a morning assembly every morning. It may be more appropriate to call it a chapel, because it really is a worship service. And we have our older students, rhetoric school students, sit with kindergartners and first graders especially, but even maybe second or third grade. It just depends upon the class, just to show them what their conduct ought to be like. Not so much to police their conduct, but just to model how they ought to worship together. And that helps to build relationships up and down through the school from top to bottom. And it's really, it really is special to the little ones, especially a kindergartner or a first grader, that a 10th grader or even a senior knows his or her name and will seek them out to shake their hand or get hugs. That really has been good for our culture. And we do other things, but that's one important thing. And then the 5th grade class cares for the kindergarten class at lunchtime. So I talked a moment ago about teaching what good conversation is at lunchtime, teaching table manners, good etiquette at lunchtime. The 5th graders help the kindergartners learn those lessons to varying degrees of success, of course, but there's interaction going on there. That is really special to the kindergartners. They love their 5th grade helpers, and the 5th graders come to love the kindergartners too, so we break down some of those barriers, and it makes our whole community tighter knit.
We have a few things. We have a house system that helps with mentoring, so that just provides a natural conduit for older students having relationships with younger students. They see them throughout the school campus, and they know who they are because they have a connection. And that's a blessing. When we have our chapel on a weekly basis, we stand in our houses and commit that who are you going to serve? As for me and my house, we are going to serve the Lord. And then they have a time where they're just there to chat with each other, and the house leaders inform their house about the school announcements, so that those announcements don't just come from the school administration, but from the coolest kids on the campus. And we elevate their leadership and elevate their sense of responsibility. They communicate with me about areas of need or concern or anything that they see. And then we take action on that. Looking for ways for mentorship, another area, our older students join the last recess of the day for our youngest students. So that's just 10 minutes where they're in the habit, the upper school students are in the habit of just needing a 10-minute break in the afternoon, and we find that that's a very productive time for them to schedule that 10-minute break during the last recess of our youngest students, and so that they learn as older students that their task actually for that break is to love on someone else and to care for them. Look for the kid who's the furthest out and the most isolated. Bring them in, spend time with them, give them instant fame by being with them, with the basketball in your hand. I think that's been helpful. There are a number of other ways, I think, just in terms of service time, when we do service, we do also do a service for our school. Our older students are seen caring for the building every day at lunchtime. And so the younger students are receiving that service, and they hold them up as models and leaders. And then when we have service projects, it's always the oldest students leading their house, which includes the youngest students, in a service that our school is doing for a project that either the school has thought of or the student council has thought of. So those are just some ways.
The thing that comes to mind is we have reading buddies. So the sixth graders are assigned a first grader. And once a week during the last recess, the sixth graders give their recess away and come in and read with their reading buddy. So it's a sixth grader and a first grader, and they have a little stack of books, and their job is to make it as far as they can through the books. And they're the same all year long, so they get to know each other, and it's pretty neat to see the interaction that takes place there, and really good practice for the little ones too.
Since you have the mic, there's a question for you to address, if you can, quickly. How to handle premature romance?
I don't know if I can handle it well quickly. So the short form is we're death on it. And so I think that there's a couple things. One is being death on it is not the same thing as being petty about it or thinking that romance in general is bad. You know, it's three cheers for holding hands and kissing and romantic love, right place, right time, right person. But we start in second grade, and I go in and talk to the elementary kids once a year about what our expectations are for them and what their temptations might be. And in the lower elementary, it tends, at least for us, it tends to be more of joking / immature gossip about things. You know, a guy and a girl sit down at the lunch table together because that's where they are in line, and somebody else is convinced that they're going to get married. And so there's not a lot of genuine sparks flying in second or third grade, but there's a temptation to joke about it or gossip about it, and so we discourage kids from that. And in the upper elementary, you know, same thing. Talk to them about that. We have pastors that come in and talk to our secondary kids once every other year about the topic. So we try not to be anal about it, if you will, but we are. We're pretty jealous for the environment that we have, and we want to make sure that it stays healthy. So there aren't kids getting busted all the time for being too close to a girl. But if you have a young man singling out a young girl and they're at the lunch table together for a couple days in the row and nobody else is around, I would talk to him. And my encouragement is to create some healthy space.
You've all talked about teaching and training, and so this question is, what training do teachers need to be able to navigate the teaching and training requirement? And kind of appended to that, are there things teachers need to unlearn before they're ready to train students?
I think the process of our faith and the sanctifying of our lives is that we are always in the process of putting off and putting on. So we're always unlearning something, but you can't unlearn something unless you put something else in its place. And so we are to put off ungodliness and to put on godliness. And I think that we can be very overly prescriptive about what that looks like. You've discussed it as house rules and different standards. And I think that it's actually easier to prescribe than it is to describe and to live it out and to think it through. So I think that as a school, it's wise to sit down before the school year begins and say, what do you think is true and good and beautiful about us? What are we doing well? And what are you frustrated about? What do you think is a real concern? Is it a concern about us? Is it a concern about outside of these walls, the community, the culture that we are in the midst of, where there is creep into your school? And then to say, so what are we going to do about that? And what does that look like? I think for me, any time that I have said, here's the scope and sequence for how you are going to think more Christianly about this topic, it's going to backfire. So I'd rather get them invested and be deep and slow about our progress so that we're moving forward together, even if it's deeper and slower than I might want to be. I probably didn't answer anybody's question.
No, you did. I thought that was good. You know, conferences like this are helpful. That's why we like to have people come and going to teacher training. You know, if there's a teacher training that's close by that you can go to, that's a blessing. Reading books, paying attention Sunday morning during the sermon, right? I mean, it's all the little things. It's not necessarily that there's some program that you ought to ship all of your teachers out to, and if you do that, then they're going to be gold. It's there's more to it than that. And so I think we're all kind of eclectic. We're growing and learning, and some of that can take place during the school year. You know, there are little things, that little book groups that we do, and little teacher scholarship projects that I have my teachers do. It's similar to what Leslie was talking about, where they get to choose an area that they need to grow, and then they pursue it. And then we just do a show and tell at the end of the school year. But there's an expectation on staff that none of us is good enough. None of us is qualified. And if that's the understanding, if everybody knows that we're not good enough to do this job that God's called us to, then the expectation is we better be working. You know, and then the only question is, what's it going to be this year? What are you going to tackle this year? Which area are you going to choose? Sometimes it's really simple. Like one of my options for my experienced teachers is read the New Testament this year. They get a little chart, keep track of reading the New Testament. They come in at the show and tell and say, I did it. You know, here's my chart. I read the New Testament. And then I want to know, how's that going to make you a better teacher? That's part of the show and tell. What did you do? How's it going to make you a better teacher? Could be a reading list that they put together. Could be Christian worldview of literature, and they really want to work on that. There's a couple books that they don't feel like they haven't figured out. But the self-directedness of it, I think, is really good, especially for teachers who have been around for a while.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor the point because I agree with everything they said, and especially Leslie in her opening remarks talked a lot about personal holiness for us as teachers. That's key, okay, personal holiness. One of the things that we do that hasn't been mentioned yet is we meet for a couple of weeks before school starts, and we just go back and go over why we are who we are, why we do what we do. And I think a lot of the things about scriptural principles and house rules and those kinds of things sort of flesh themselves out No, wearing white tennis shoes, that's not going to save your soul. But here's why we do it. Okay, this is why we do it. It's our house rule. This is why we do it. So sorting that out, especially for new teachers, and then having experienced teachers who are willing to give the time to the new teachers who are trying to unlearn some things. We have a lot of people, not at our school yet, but I see in other schools, we have a lot of people coming in from government schools where you may not address a student for running in the hall. Well, we want our teachers to address a student for running in the hall for the right reasons. We want them to be able to explain what's wrong with it, okay? And so having those experienced teachers to come alongside after the initial conversations of, you know, here's why we do the things that we do.
Just following up on that, you mentioned the white tennis shoes policy. Are there some strategies to use to help get faculty and families on the same page with regard to uniforms, especially as the year goes on and it gets a little more slipshod?
The short answer for Trinitas is we are a board-run school, and the board chooses the uniforms. There's not a committee of parents who do that. The board chooses the uniforms, and if you want to come to Trinitas Christian School, this is the uniform that you wear.
That's good. We have a weird history when it comes to school uniforms. We actually grandfathered in. When we started uniforms, it was with our kindergartners only. And then the next year, it was K and 1, and then K through 2. You know, so it took us 12 years to get uniforms into the school. But as soon as the kindergartners came in their uniforms, 80% of the discussion was over because they looked great, right? I mean, they were beautiful. They looked professional. They were sharp. They looked like they were ready to go. And it was a pain in the neck to do that, to take so many years where we had multiple uniform policies depending on what grade you're in. It's neat, clean, and modest for the old kids, whatever that means, and then it's, you know, you're in the uniform for the younger kids. But I like the fact that the board was trying to honor parents and not change the rules in the middle of the game, and they were willing to be patient and stick it out. There was a time when we tightened up our uniform policy where I felt like I really wanted to sell it to my secondary kids. So, and I think it's good enough to say, hey, look, we're all under authority, and the people that are in authority over us have made this decision. But I wanted our secondary kids to get it, to know why. And so I took an athletic route and showed them a picture of the USA Dream Team, all in uniform, where all the colors were matching. And then I had another picture where I'd tinkered with the color of some guy's shoes and the color of some of the shorts, so they were a little bit off. And my motivation was to have it click. Maybe not with everybody, but with a majority of the kids, for them to see why the change was taking place, and to at least be able to empathize for why someone would want that and why it might make our school better and might actually be a gift instead of a theft that was taking place. Mm-hmm. So less so with the elementary. You know, our elementary kids tend to be pretty clueless and just kind of do what they do and do what their parents want them to do. Secondary kids, I try to work with them more so they see it and get it.
Those are great thoughts. I appreciate what you've said. So in the same, looking at where does it break down, I think some of the areas where it breaks down are not because parents are looking for ways to defy the school and show their lack of support. That's not it. It's not that they would just stop paying tuition if that were the case. I think it's often areas of blindness in a family's life. I think about families where they're so completely stressed out in the mornings that the shirt being tucked in and the belt was the last thing on their minds. And what I don't want to be is the person with my arms crossed and my old age setting in, looking at them and letting them feel completely insignificant and incapable as a parent. So I think it would be really helpful to observe and note and see patterns. And the teacher is doing that too. And then say, hey, are you seeing this? I'm seeing a real habit with this. What do you think is going on here? And then let the teacher reach out to that family, say, hey, I just noticed this. Just want to talk about that. Everything okay? Need help? How can we support you? Girls in their early tweens begin to, some girls, not all girls, but some girls, particularly the neediest, will want to set themselves apart and demonstrate how unique they are because they don't understand that they're more unique as an image bearer than they are as the way that they dress. You know, I could get hard on that, and I want to, and I've pulled girls in and said, you know what, sweetheart, I know you love those boots. I know you love those commando boots, but and I get that they are telling me who you are, but you see, I want you to know who you are in Christ, and I need you to stop being your first priority of advertising. So if you do this again, I know need you to know that I'm going to send you home, and I'm going to tell you not to come back until tomorrow without those boots on. Are we clear? We're clear. But it really means that I need to follow up with the mom and dad who don't understand what's going on with that child's heart. And I actually need to earn some relational capital before I start drawing on that investment. And so that involves me loving them, caring for them. And I could just simply say, or you're out. But I don't want to. I want them to be in. I want them to be in and loving the uniform because of what it represents, because it represents someone who cares for them.
You've all mentioned points of the day, and I think there are pressure points during the day where culture is really visible. One of them is morning. Ron talked about the morning assembly. Leslie, you talked about lunch. What two other potential pressure points are transitional times and the end of the day? Are there routines at your schools for those things that that you train? Or thoughts on that? So transitions and end of day.
This is an area where I think we can grow as a school. Transitions within the classroom.
It could be in the classroom or to a special or mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So.
Well, to transition between classes for us means you're walking through our courtyard, and that means that you are going in a special space that everyone shares. And so we teach them how to love those around them, walk in a line. Some of our teachers have them walk in a line with their hands behind their backs in order to just keep them still. I'm not that's a classic kindergarten teacher thought there, and I respect that. But just teaching them to look at their neighbor and what their neighbor's doing and loving them, I don't think that's new to schools. Transitions, though, I think the most important thing in terms of truth and beauty and goodness, rather than control, is to utilize your time as best as possible in a way that honors others and is glorifying and beautiful. And that may mean that the best way to transition is with a song that allows you to accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Transitions within the classroom during the school day, we practice a lot during the first 2 weeks. And so the ability to put your literature book away and get your math book out, which seems really easy, is actually something that we have to coach. Maybe it's just Logos kids, but we have to teach and train and encourage and cheer for them and practice it a number of times. And we think that it's worth it to spend the first week or the first 2 weeks wasting a lot of time practicing the simple things. So we practice how to line up at recess time, you know, with when it's not recess. So the individual classroom teachers will bring their classes out there and ring the bell just to practice. You know, and that's an assembly saying for us. If I say lines, they'll say sprint, straight, silent, clap, clap, clap. And so they know that you sprint to line, your line needs to be straight, and your line needs to be silent. And We just waste a lot of academic time during the first 2 weeks of the school year, because we know that once you get into a rhythm, you can make up that time and more, because you can make your transitions without having to wait or without having to give long reminders or coach or actually go out and take that book out of the desk for the young man who seems incapable of doing it himself. So we spend a lot of time. It's just kind of like boot camp. This is life in second grade, and here are the things that are going to help us navigate this place well.
How's the question stacked? We have lots of questions because I think everything's been said that I would say.
No, that's fine. Okay. End of the day, yes.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I don't know how many of you got to see Mrs. Rollins' talk yesterday just about classroom practices, classroom liturgies. Just a blessing and a leaving liturgy, the Lord be with you and also with you, and a hug. I don't think we've had it to that extent at our school. I know we have teachers who you got to line up and hug the teacher to get out. For me, it's stopping 2 or 3 minutes, 5 minutes before the end of the day and saying, let's all take a breath. What do we need to do tonight? What do we have to look forward to tomorrow? And then, you know, go in the peace of the Lord. But there needs to be something to punctuate the day. I have heard of, and I'm jealous of this, I've heard of a school, and some of you may be from that school, where the students come into the hallways the last 5 minutes of the day and sing. I don't know if it's the doxology or what, but that would be a great way to punctuate the day. There needs to be a bookend of some kind there. I mean, even if it's just a simple blessing, the Lord be with you, there needs to be a bookend of some kind.
Okay. Parents, the parental role in the true, the good, and the beautiful, how can we help parents understand how to assist the school in building a true and good and beautiful community?
Probably the hardest part, because our job is to come alongside the parents. And the problem that we have, and I think this is pretty common, is we have lots of parents who really don't understand what we're doing. They see the end product. They want help, as Mr. Whitling said in his talk before this. They see the end product. They want help. But then when they get in the midst of it, it's really hard. It's hard work to get to that end product. And so relationship is what I would say. We invite them in at the beginning of the day for our morning meeting. We want them in there. They can sit with their children, or they can sit at the back of the room, or they can have their children sit at the back of the room with them. We want them being part of that beginning of the day. We invite them to the classrooms. Now, they can't just come and go willy-nilly. They have to sign in, but they're welcome to come anytime, all day long. They're encouraged to come and eat lunch with their children. And then we just have all sorts of barbecues and bonfires and different things like that to put especially new parents, but even parents who have been there for a year or two and things are really starting to get hard, to put them in a position to be able to talk to the seasoned parents, the parents who get it, if you will, because it's a discipling process is what it is for the parents as much as it is for the children, or that's what we found.
Did you have something? I think that the most important part of helping, again, as you said, coming alongside of parents, we're partnering with parents. It's actually their role, and they actually have more authority into their child's life at home or into their child's life that we do. So the real issue is, how do I get them to ask me how they can be better at instilling truth and goodness and beauty? And I think it's relationship, and being a safe place. You can do the adolescent thing of letting them know who's in charge and letting them know that you know more than they do. Or you can do the godly and humble thing, which is to, as Matt said, let them know that you don't think you're qualified. And you're qualified, but you're not qualified, and that you want to be with them in what you're doing together. And I think the more honest and transparent and humble you are, the more likely that they're going to say, I do want to work with you. I'm not afraid of you. You are with me, and I want to be with you. And so let's build together. And then the bonfires and all of those great things that you do, I think will be more effective. I'm starting this year a monthly support and seminar discussion group, because there are families that are saying, I do want to know more. I really need to know more. And I've done a number of different lecture on this, lecture on that, let's do a book talk. But I'm just going to make it a type of a support group, because I want our families to think of themselves as a mini culture. And I'm prayerful that that will be effective, so that people can develop some relationships together.
Teachers can sometimes be a challenge to our true and beautiful, good and beautiful community too. And so the question is, how once a situation has been addressed biblically, Matthew 18, with a teacher who's been speaking threateningly or demeaningly to students. Once it's been dealt with biblically, what's next? How long would you tolerate a teacher's behavior that way?
So you said a teacher is threatening.
Yeah. How long should students? I was trying to frame the question, but how long should behavior of a teacher be tolerated when he or she speaks threateningly or demeaningly to students, assuming it has been addressed biblically?
Right. Well, you know, it depends on what he or she said and what the context was and all of that. But sometimes dealing with it biblically means not having them around anymore. So that's certainly a possibility. I wouldn't rush to that. I haven't done this very often, but I have issued a formal letter of reprimand to a teacher in the past, and this may be the sort of situation where that would be appropriate. It really depends on how severe it was, but let's say a teacher loses her cool and says something that was inappropriate, and the Holy Spirit convicted her of it, and she made things right with her class, and as far as you can tell, everything's good. As an administrator, I would think, great, you know, we've made things right. And then my next thought would be, how do we ensure that this doesn't happen again? And if it continues, that's a teacher that I can't continue to employ. So formal letter of reprimand can state that in a clear and hopefully gracious way, so that the teacher knows this is a really big deal.
In what ways have you integrated curriculum with training students in the culture that you desire? In other words, how do you break down the barrier between teaching the curriculum, getting the classroom work done, and training the students? Are there bridges you can build between those, or jump in?
it's all the same thing in my mind. When I look at it, it's you have these students, you know, and you have academic goals for them. You also have spiritual goals for them, and it's all one big party. You know, you're marching along the pathway, and the pathway is set by your curriculum, and some of the curricular goals are spiritual, and you know, sometimes you're in a Bible class learning about Exodus, and other times you're in a history class and you see integration between the two, and the integration might be an object lesson that has a spiritual real application to the students' lives, or it may just be an academic lesson where you think, wow, I can see an echo of this poetry lesson that we learned in this literature book that we're reading. But it's all in the soup.
Exactly. I completely agree. I would say this is a visual for me, and intentionally placed as a daily visual for our school. We have windows in our hall that were just bringing in enormous amounts of blinding light. And so we needed to have some screens made to help that light. Well, we had this great idea. Why don't we make them look like stained glass? And why don't we put, among other things, the seven liberal arts across the windows, starting with grammar, logic, and rhetoric into the quadrivium. And then following that is truth, goodness, and beauty. And following that is wisdom and virtue. And the point of it is that grammar, logic, and rhetoric and the trivium and quadrivium are the journey and the process by which we are pursuing the ability to defend and honor and understand truth and goodness and beauty in the constant pursuit of wisdom and virtue. It's a lifelong journey, and the liberal arts are our means by which we accomplish that. And so that is the curriculum. Surely grammar is truth, goodness, and beauty. It's just one means of that for us.
And just to sort of add on to that, I think we look for ways to draw out truth, goodness, and beauty in everything that we're teaching. Mrs. Collins mentioned grammar. Grammar, writing, penmanship, these things really lend themselves to that, because God is a God of order and is a God of beauty, and grammar brings order to language. Writing can be beautiful, it can be true and beautiful or not. Penmanship is an excellent way, especially for the little bitty guys, to see beauty. Okay, this is where you can actually make something beautiful, or your teacher can't even read it. You know, so that's a real practical thing, I think.
Any other questions? If I could just add to that last thing, it's amazing what students, even grammar school students, can come up with in terms of applying their curriculum to a true, good, and beautiful community. Our fourth graders study Kings, and after studying King Ahab and Naboth's vineyard, they came up with, on their own, don't be an Ahab. When you don't get your way. So I mean, they made a poster for the room, don't be an Ahab. So it's surprising sometimes what even students can do to train themselves or to train each other. All right, thank you for your time. Thank you, panelists. Let's give them a round of applause. You are dismissed.